An interesting place to start actually would be kind of what we were talking a little bit earlier about how the way that I'm doing things with my podcast sort of serves as like a filtering mechanism, which is quite useful. You don't actually have to actively filter everything that comes in because the magnet that you're putting out is kind of like a filter in and of itself. And one kind of analogy I think about is like Elon Musk has like the most powerful magnet in the world, right? He's got like 100 whatever million followers. And so that attracts, all the smartest people in the world, probably, or most of them. And then also a bunch of, it attracts everyone. And for him to filter that is like a very non-trivial problem to be able to identify like the best followers he has and stuff like that. For me, like my podcast, I think it's a much more like finely tuned magnet because I'm not trying to attract that next level of people who aren't like the ultimate like best match who kind of discovered my podcast organically or whatever. And I feel like, that's what we were talking about with your fund as well. Like you guys aren't, pedal to the metal on marketing or like really trying to get in people's faces. And so the people who come to respect One Confirmation are really people who are like kind of the right people to have discovered it. And it helps, take a lot of that filtering out of your hands. Obviously, you still have to do some, but the people who get to you are like really high quality leads. So maybe you could talk a little bit about like how you've gone about just the origin story for One Confirmation and how you've gone about sort of presenting it in public and your strategy and how it differentiates from these other crypto funds.
For sure. And to that point, before I talk about kind of the background, I think particularly when you're kind of an early stage venture fund like we are, kind of investing seed stage, pre-product, kind of early, you want founders that don't really give a fuck about prestige or kind of brand. Those are often the best founders that are going to do really unique things that are important for the world. So I think particularly when you're kind of a seed stage fund that is trying to be laser focused at making important bets in kind of pre-product, I think that strategy works especially well. Where if you're a later stage fund or something like that, then you're really playing the prestige game. So and what I love to do is early stage crypto, kind of bleeding edge. I mean, my background, I first bought my first Bitcoin in 2012. Back then, to buy Bitcoin in the US, you had to go to an ATM, take out cash, then go to a local Walgreens and MoneyGram it to some sketchy exchange in Japan, right? Mt. Gox. That was like my first Bitcoin purchase experience. And a couple months later, after that first experience, I saw Brian Armstrong launch Coinbase on Hacker News. And like, I've always been an internet person. So when I saw Coinbase, it just solved a problem that I had, which was, it was a pain in the ass to go through all those steps just to buy Bitcoin. And Brian just made it easy to link a bank account and buy Bitcoin. So I was like one of the first 100 or so users of Coinbase. And that was how, I got into crypto.
Can I ask a quick question on
Yeah.
the early purchase of Bitcoin? What gave you the conviction, if you can recall back? Like, I don't expect you to remember the decision like super precisely or whatever, but it takes like, explicit action to like go through all that friction to purchase that Bitcoin. You can't just be like, hey, you stumble across a link on the website and it's like, oh, you press buy or you don't press buy. Even that takes getting over the hump of like actually pressing the button, the default being not pressing the button, but to go out of your way and do like a Western Union and all that, you really have to sort of care about this thing. Why did you care enough to go and actually do that?
I thought it was a very interesting and important social movement. That was like what kind of hooked me. So, I first read a Wired article talking about this magic internet money that was being used to buy guns and drugs on Silk Road. That was the early narrative. And I've always been an internet person. So like the first thing I did after learning about Bitcoin was I wanted to see who was online talking about it. And I stumbled into Bitcoin Talk, which was like the first online forum that Satoshi actually created, where it was people talking about Bitcoin. And I saw like the media narrative was one thing, right? The focus on, Silk Road and, Bitcoin being used to buy guns and drugs and kind of all these negative narratives. But the truth was very different. There was this passionate community of people from around the world. They weren't aligned by physical location, but they all were aligned by economic incentives. They all owned Bitcoin. And they had shared beliefs. You know, some of the early, you know, beliefs around Bitcoin, like inclusion and transparency and things like that. So I saw back then, even as like my initial thinking, and obviously it wasn't this crystallized at the time, but it was like, it felt like an important social movement. And really kind of what it was back then and what it still is in crypto is like kind of these online nation states forming, again, where it's not physical location, but it is economic incentives and shared beliefs. So yeah. that was what hooked me.
Yeah. So one thing that kind of stands out about that is, like you said, you didn't have like necessarily, the thoughts weren't like super crystallized. It's just like, hey, like, you know, I've always been like an internet guy, and here's like internet money, and this is a social movement. It just kind of like feels important. And that's mm-hmm. not like a thesis you can like bring to, you know, an investment committee necessarily. But mm-hmm. when you are your own personal investment committee or whatever, you can do whatever you want. How much of that sort of like just going off of gut and just sort of like, you know, not necessarily being able to crystallize the thing because it is kind of early and hard to wrap your head around, how much of that carries over to your approach today with One Confirmation? Like, do you find that you have a higher threshold that you have to get over in terms of being able to explicitly, you know, explain why you're interested in something, or can you still operate on gut to a large degree?
100% gut, 100% gut. Like I invest in what I like. That is like our, and we invest, you know, we have a team now, but you know, we invest in what we like. That's our core, you know, strategy. And we're not, I find that so much of venture capital is about like investing in narratives. And I think when you invest in narratives, that leads to problems. You're kind of investing in something that you don't really understand, but you know, the narrative sounds good. I think what's been a great strategy for us is just kind of investing in the early stage products that we understand from a user perspective and like. And so, yeah, that was Bitcoin in 2012. You know, a month ago, that was Degen, which is a new cryptocurrency that's native to Farcaster. And it was a similar, you know, reasoning then than it was when I kind of gravitated to Bitcoin, you know, 11 or 12 years ago or whatever. So
yeah, it's interesting. I actually like had that degen bet kind of in mind when I was, you know, asking that last mm-hmm. question, because I've been kind of, you know, experimenting with it a little bit and you know, put a little personal investment in there or whatever, and I've been able to actually earn it by getting like tips on Farcaster and everything, which is super mm-hmm. cool. And you know, like I kind of feel that like gut. Like, I love that bet that you guys made, because I feel that like gut feeling that like, hey, you know, here's, people have been kind of talking about like crypto social media for a long time, and or a relatively long time. It kind of makes sense as like a next thing. You know, there's like money, and then there's like finance in general, and social media is like kind of an obvious, you know, area where censorship resistant, like social media makes a lot of sense after, you know, we saw the president of the United States get banned from all these social media sites or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so you see, you know, there's been experiments with BitCloud and, you know, Lens and, you know, a handful of others. But Farcaster, you know, I played with all of those, like BitCloud and, you know, more recently, like FriendTech and Lens and all of these. And most of them started very money focused and took off like insanely, like very quickly, and then crashed, you know, equally quickly. And I'm not going to rule any of them out, because, you know, Bitcoin itself and many of these crypto projects rise and crash really, really fast and then come back. So, you know, who knows what could be, you know, maybe BitCloud does come back or whatever, but Farcaster has been like distinctly different, with coming out with like not a money focus, very slowly, very like deliberate growth, trying to focus on like quality community. And now, like a couple of years later, however long it's been, it feels like something for the first time, like over the last maybe like 6 months versus the prior year or whatever, that it doesn't feel like it's going to go away. It feels like it would be too painful for too many people, to just like kind of go away. Mm-hmm. And you see Degen like kind of emerge as kind of this, like, you know, it wasn't like built by the Farcaster people or anything like that, but it's just kind of become this like default paired currency, similar to how like Base has become like the paired, you know, layer two. And who knows, you know, if either of those things will persist, but all you can really do is like kind of identify these things early and try to make a, you know, high conviction bet on them, even though you can't really have that high conviction, just like someone betting on Bitcoin early. So it's interesting because like I see DeGen and I'm like, man, like my gut is like, that's really interesting. And like, I like that and it's fun and people are using it and like some things line up here, but I couldn't like, I don't think I could like convince an investment committee on it. You know what I mean? So is that, that's basically sort of like how you think about things as well.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I agree with most of what you said. I mean, it's funny, a lot of people, you know, the past couple of weeks or whatever, like, wow, that was such a bold bet on DeGen, you know, because it was perceived as a, you know, a meme coin and things like that. I think the truth is that was probably the easiest bet and the highest conviction and the quickest I've come to a decision on an investment, you know, in the past several years. And the reason is actually, it's two things we just talked about. One, the founder, Jacek, who it's funny, he actually, I didn't realize this until after, but then someone casted it on Farcaster. He had just reached out, he casted about one confirmation, like 3 months before DeGen launched or something. He casted, I love the way you guys operate. Would love to talk to you or something like that. And
right,
we missed it at the time, but I mean, Jacek is just the, you know, this type of founder that, you know, self-selects because of how we've operated and the brand that we have. That's not this out there brand, but I think the people that know, right. So Jacek, you know, and just, his, you know, quality was part of the reason it was a no-brainer. And the other was just because I loved the product. I loved the community. I, like you, you know, have been very interested in decentralized social for a long time. The one that kind of DeGen brought me back to was Steemit. So I don't know if you, do you remember Steemit?
I've heard of it, but I never used it.
Okay, so Steemit was maybe 2016 kind of crypto or something. And it was a decentralized Reddit that basically had economic incentives baked in where you make a post and you could earn money. And there was a token distribution that basically didn't really work. It had miners as well and kind of early founders, and the value of your tip was based on how many tokens you already owned. And because it was like there was a small group of people that mined early and kind of allocated the tokens to the founders, basically like eight people had all the power to curate and tip people in that network. And so if you, you know, if you made a post and the founder of Steemit saw it, you would earn you know, $5,000 worth of tokens. And but you know, if anyone else saw it, you earned 10 cents or something.
Right.
So some really interesting early ideas, and there was probably a bunch of reasons why it didn't work. But particularly, I had been thinking about that for a long time. And then when I saw DeGen come along, and it has this really interesting token distribution that allocates tips based on reactions per cast, that felt like a really good distribution mechanism. So like Vitalik, I think right now has the highest reactions per cast on Farcaster. So he's allocated the most tips. Now he's not using them, and if you don't use them, they go away, which I think is another interesting mechanic. But the you know, the quality of content as measured by you know, casts or reactions per cast is how the tips get distributed. And I just love this as a way to bring new users into crypto. And you know, our decision-making process is the founder good? Do we like the product? And is this something that could push crypto forward and bring in new users? And DeGen had all those, right? So that's kind of why it was a very easy decision. And I mean, on investment committee, I mean, we're a small team and we move really quick. So I think we've built a lot of trust for LPs. So it's, you know, it's not this you know, extensive process or anything as that. It's do we like the founder? Do we like the product? Does this push crypto forward? If those, you know, if we feel strongly about those, then, you know, we're in. And it was a very, very quick decision with DGen on those three.
Yeah, it's I'm going to have Jacek actually on the podcast. Maybe it might come out like right after this one, actually. So that'll be pretty cool to do a deep dive on that. And this is a good little preview. But it's interesting, too, even down to the name of like DGen, because there's something, I think, to the fact that like it's named DGen, which is like the most like, you know, DGen slash like meme coin like name ever. Like you couldn't, you know, obviously there's all these dog coins, you can name it after a dog. But besides that, like DGen is like just screams like meme coin and like DGen or whatever. But it's like not that really. Yeah. Like it's not as much that, at least, as other coins, which are just kind of like doing, you know, the same thing as the rest of them, which is more or less nothing or whatever. And it's, I don't know, I think it's interesting when people kind of like mistitle things in a way that can be useful. Like the example I always use, I don't know if it's like the best one, but like Chance the Rapper. It's like his music actually, I don't know if you're familiar with him, but like his music actually like isn't that much like rap. Like it kind of is, but he's like kind of a singer. And when you mistitle something, you like kind of get the attention of the people who are looking for that thing, but they then realize like this is kind of different than the rest of the people in that thing or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of an interesting name.
Counter signal. I would describe that as kind of a counter signal, right? I think about counter signals a lot. There's kind of the signal, and then the truth, or, you know, or what the thing really is.
Right.
So that's, counter signals is kind of, you know, important to how we think about kind of investing in the world, for sure.
Yeah. I saw you had a, one, you know, you've been doing the screenshot essays on Farcaster. I love the screenshot essays as just a, it's an interesting in-between form of content where it's not quite as long as even a blog post, which is already an interesting in between like a tweet and like a book or something. A screenshot essay is like fall somewhere between like a tweet and a blog, and it's just kind of like an interesting low weight quick read type of thing. So I like that you're doing those. And I saw you had one on these counter signals. I think the context was basically around like if the media, I think it was like the media got behind Ron DeSantis, and that's almost like a sign that, like, you know, Trump's probably going to get the backing of like most of the Republican people, because people see what's reported in the headlines and they kind of want to go against that in a way or something like that. Is that roughly like a good example of the counter signal, how you think about it?
Yeah. I think the people that optimize for status, perception, that's often a counter signal about who they really are. I mean, that's kind of what I believe. So I think there's people that optimize for status and people that optimize for truth. And often people that are playing the status game are, you know, the signal is that they're good, prestigious, elite, whatever. And the truth is very different.
Right.
So I think, you know, it applies to a lot of different things, and, you know, it's not always the case. But I think it's the case a lot more than most people recognize, because, you know, most people recognize just the prestige is the prestige, but the prestige or the, you know, the good or whatever is not often as it seems. And I think the internet is kind of exposing that more and more, and people are going to realize that more and more.
Right. So switching gears a little bit, when you started the fund in 2017, you know, that was like a hype cycle in and of itself, and really like Ethereum's first, let alone anything else. And so you were, you know, presumably very bullish on like Ethereum at that time, among other things in crypto, not just Bitcoin, but also Bitcoin. You raised, I think, $26 million for Fund One. And my understanding, could be wrong, but I think you basically took some of that money and just invested it straight into like Bitcoin and Ethereum, and then took the rest and started allocating it into these early stage projects. How did you think about like that strategy from the get-go, where other funds might have just focused on, you know, holding their whatever funds they raised in dollars and then investing in, you know, early stage projects like a typical VC. Others might have taken like more of a hedge fund strategy and just invested in these public, you know, cryptocurrencies. You kind of, you know, split the middle a little bit and had to decide on like maybe proportions and allocations and things like that. Like, how did you think about that initial strategy, and has it changed over time?
Mm-hmm. So I think one really smart decision I made, which is very simple. But at that time, it was all crypto hedge funds that were popping up. You know, there's a big crypto hedge fund meme, and thousands of crypto hedge funds, you know, were out. And I think they were structured as hedge funds because you know, they were investing in mostly public cryptocurrency, which, you know, on the surface looks like, you know, public equity or something like that. That the hedge fund structure is I think still not a great structure for this asset class, because I still see kind of public crypto as having like venture like risk reward, where either it's, you know, 10x, even Ethereum now if it works, or, you know, zero if it doesn't. And so you need to treat crypto like venture, not public equity. That's kind of what I believe from both a risk reward and portfolio allocation perspective. Now, some people might be good at trading or whatever and being able to generate alpha, but I haven't seen many of those people, truthfully, and you know, the decade plus that I've been in the industry. So the problem with the hedge fund is the incentive model, which is, you know, as a fund manager, whether it's venture or hedge fund, you make money two ways, with carry and with management fees. And the hedge fund model is, you basically get an annual management fee and also, you know, annual carry. And that's problematic because you can have a $100 million fund that's up 100% in year one. The GP gets 20% carry, makes, you know, 20 million, call it. And then you have year two down 50%. The GP is still up millions, and the LPs are now down, right? So the venture structure, this is long-winded. I'm not sure if your audience really even cares about this, but it's basically the venture structure is a better model where, as a GP, you're fundamentally aligned with, you know, with LPs, and you're only making money when your LPs are making money. And I think, you know, I think it, just to make it a bit more general, is like financial alignment is really important in, you know, whatever the business is. And I think a lot of things go wrong when you have kind of a misalignment between, you know, the founders, the CEO or whatever, and the shareholders or the LPs or whatever. So hedge fund, bad model for this industry, and maybe just generally, because you know, there's other, I have a bunch of hedge fund hedge fund managers that basically told me this when I first started. Like, I didn't initially know much about hedge funds at all. So then the other, I guess, to just address, so we structure as a venture fund. We definitely want crypto exposure, because fundamentally, the cryptocurrencies to me are the most important thing, right? You have this new model where the users are aligned with the developers and the creators. So it was important to invest in cryptocurrencies. I think that's the main thing, still is, but also really want to be able to invest in kind of the businesses that are, you know, bringing crypto to more people. And so that's why it was this kind of hybrid venture structure. And yeah, that's still exactly what we're doing. I mean, we haven't changed much since that fund one. I'm still kind of investing bleeding edge crypto products, which is what I love and what energizes me. So I'm still having a lot of fun doing what we're doing.
Yeah, no, it all sounds great. And it makes sense as a strategy. And I think, you know, that what you said around financial alignment and why the hedge fund doesn't make sense makes a ton of sense. And yeah, I guess I wonder, the thing that I was kind of getting at as well is when you have, you raise this fund, $26 million, and you put a chunk of it into like Bitcoin and Ethereum, but you also have an intention to go and invest in a bunch of early stage projects, the things that you like and things that you think, they're further along on like the risk reward spectrum or whatever, but that's what you're doing as a venture fund. But to your point, like Bitcoin and Ethereum are in and of themselves like venture bets still, from your perspective, it sounds like, and certainly from mine. And so you sort of have to like, it's not like you're holding dollars in a bank account and allocating them to startups where it's like, okay, if you just hold those dollars, nothing's going to happen. So, you raise this money, go and deploy it. To me, it kind of changes the threshold on what makes a worthwhile investment when you have your funds that you've raised parked in assets that you believe really strongly in are going to produce venture level returns. And like, you're not going to get maybe like the 10,000x that you would expect to get from like a huge win in a startup investment or something that can like return the fund. But if you have 50% of the fund invested in Bitcoin and Ethereum and they both go 10x, that returns the fund 5x, even if the rest goes to zero. And that's like a really good venture fund, regardless of how it's sort of like comprised. So did that like present any challenges or differences in sort of like how you look at making investments versus more traditional venture funds?
I don't think so. I mean, to be clear, we didn't like, I mean, there's some funds that like, put everything in Bitcoin or something and then invested out of that, which we didn't do that. We had a percentage of the portfolio that we wanted to allocate to the basically the least risky bets in crypto, and we got that exposure over a long period of time, and then the rest of the fund, and that was call it 20-25% of the fund, and then the rest of the fund is in kind of new opportunities. So we're just trying to get the best kind of risk adjusted performance for our LPs. And the thing about like just putting everything in and then investing out of Bitcoin or Ether or whatever is there's more timing risk. So that works great if you're, you're raising your fund in a down market. But if you're raising your fund in a bull market, which tends to be when, it's easier to raise funds and you do that, then that could really hurt performance. So one thing someone told me very early in my kind of venture career was the single most important variable that determines the success of a fund is the vintage year, the year that it the fund starts. And so if you're raising in a in a massive bull market, then that is likely going to hurt performance a lot. If you're raising in a down market, that's going to be good for performance. The thing is, it's hard to know. And so what I took from that is let's figure out how to mitigate timing risk. And to mitigate timing risk, we kind of we methodically deploy over like a 4-year initial investment period. And we're not constantly raising funds. I put a lot of my own money in the funds, which is, again, I think something different than a lot of venture funds that are just out there raising, as much money as they can, like as quick as they can. Because I put my own money in and we're kind of, not trying to raise a bunch of funds and things like that. It's like, it allows us to really mitigate the timing risk. And I think that shows itself both in like how we kind of dollar cost average into our public crypto positions and be disciplined and keep a really high bar for like the new opportunities we're investing in.
Right. So one of the things I think that I've observed just from like, seeing what you post on like Farcast or Twitter or whatever, or writing is, and this is like going back to like maybe what like Jacek, why he like sort of reached out to you. There's just sort of like a different tone versus a lot of other, professional investors. And it strikes me as like more independent minded and like reasonable and nuanced and, uncertain in like a positive way of, willingness to be wrong and things like that. Was there an element of like sort of evaluating your own skill set that drove you to go this direction and start a fund in the first place coming out of Coinbase. And I think you had a bit of investing experience after Coinbase as well, versus, you know, going and, you know, trying to start a company or staying at Coinbase for a while, which you probably were still pretty optimistic about at that point. Why was like the investor path the one that made the most sense or was most intriguing and that drew you in to go for?
I think it's just what I'm good at. And I felt it was what, you know, I felt I had strong belief that it was kind of what I was best at. I think, you know, belief really is the most important thing. So I believed that I could be a really good investor, and it was kind of the best path for me. And then I kind of went and executed. I would say it was kind of as simple as that. I had some reason to believe that because, you know, even before I started the fund, I didn't have a ton of like formal investing experience, but I had been investing personally in crypto before that and done well. And of course, anyone who invested early in Bitcoin and had the conviction to hold did well. So I don't think that was, you know, a hugely unique thing, but whether it was or wasn't, I kind of had the belief that, you know, that was a sign that I could be good at this. And then I just kind of went out and tried it. And I think, you know, belief and just going out and trying it, like those are the two most important things that are, that anyone can really do. But it's got to, you know, you got to have the belief.
Yeah. It's interesting to hear you, like, you know, speaking of the importance of belief. It's something that I think I tend to agree with you that it's kind of like the most important thing to some degree, even though it sounds like pretty simple. Mm-hmm. Like if you kind of have to do the things that you most believe you can do, or, you know, as, you know, as an investor looking at founders, like you kind of have to like parse out that belief, and like there's various, you know, it's like not something you can really sort of like quantify, but you can certainly kind of get a sense of like, is someone building something because it kind of like makes sense to them to do on paper, or do they have this like sort of, it's easy to have something that you believe that well, I'll use the word, even though it's not really, it's kind of going for the opposite intention, but like something that you believe will work because of like what you have on paper. And then some like sort of information changes or like you have something that switches and you no longer sort of like believe in that thing, versus if you have the belief and there's almost like less of a rationale for that belief, then that belief is like much harder to kill because mm-hmm. like new information can't really come about to change your mind. So I think that's a really interesting way to go about things. And certainly that's the way that I've sort of navigated in life, like so far, at least over the last several years, is just kind of trying to follow my interests and maintain that faith and like belief sort of like at all costs, because that's kind of like recognizing that as the most important thing.
And irrespective of what the social validation is too, right? Like I think I think you get this, but like, you know, I see it in my own life a lot. It's like, you know, most people really care about social validation, and the social validation piece, I think, is what fucks up belief for a lot of people. So it's got to be like a belief that truly comes internally and is not too based on external.
Yeah, there's this interesting thing that kind of relates to that, I think, which is one of the ways that I've come to basically believe in the importance of belief or you know, faith is you look at these things that are complete opposites that people have tremendous faith in that actually appear to work for both sets of people. So a couple examples are like people kind of swear by there's certain people who kind of like swear by like saying no to everything. Mm-hmm. Like if you say no to everything, like you'll be ultra focused or whatever. And like that just, these people like absolutely swear by that. Like the second I started saying no to everything, like my life completely changed. And then there's, you know, there's like a movie called Yes Man, right? Where like this guy, Jim Carrey, like says yes to everything and like completely changes his life. And there's like a whole cult of people who like swear by saying yes to everything. And on the one hand, you could sort of like critique that and you'd be like, well, you know, this cult is like lying or, you know, something like that. But if you give them actually both just like a little bit of the benefit of the doubt, it's like there is a world in which both of those could be working for both of those sets of people. If the thing that's most important isn't actually the saying yes or the saying no, but the belief and the faith that the saying yes or the saying no is going to work really well. And another example of that is like, you know, vegans versus like carnivores. And that's even more kind of controversial maybe because it's like a physiological thing and like diet is like, you know, it actually reacts with the body and whatnot. But even there, I can't help but wonder if there's some sort of like element to, you know, the vegans and the carnivores could both sort of be right in that it doesn't really matter so long as they have like this supreme confidence that what they're doing is correct.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, yeah, when you mentioned that, I also think in cryptocurrency, right? It's like there's some cryptocurrencies that, you know, some people think are really stupid, but other people strongly believe in and it works really well for them. So I think, yeah, if you have belief, then it can work really well for you, you know, really regardless of what you're doing.
Yeah, I'm glad you you brought up the relevance to crypto because you have spoken about, at least if not written about, how like, you know, Bitcoin is ultimately like a belief system. It's kind of like a meme coin, like at the end of the day. And obviously it's, you know, got its differences or whatever. It's like the original and all that. But
I think meme coins are obviously really hot right now. I think a meme coin is kind of, for most people, at least, again, words mean different things to different people, but for most people, meme coin is like a derogatory term for a coin that either they don't own or they don't like. So, you know, whatever right. It is, dog with hat, if you don't own it, don't like it, oh, that's a meme coin. But for the people that, that own it and find it useful, it's just a cryptocurrency. And Bitcoin, you know, started that way as a meme coin that 99.9% of the world didn't own and didn't like. And so it was, you know, it was this, you know, pile of garbage. But there were people that liked it. And then over time, the perception shifted and now Bitcoin is digital gold, right? So I think kind of we've seen in cryptocurrency, every coin really starts as kind of a meme coin and then becomes, you know, sometimes, you know, the thing is 99% or probably of these meme coins, they might be hot for a moment in time and then go away. But, you know, some of them persist and the meme grows over time and become worth, you know, billions of dollars in market value. Right. So that's how I see it, at least. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple, I don't disagree with the take on meme coins or anything. I actually, you know, it brings me back to Bitcoin where I wrote, you know, there's tons of different things that you could sort of like write about Bitcoin. You could get all technical or whatever, but like at the end of the day, the first thing I think I wrote and shared publicly on Bitcoin was like Bitcoin as a belief system. And the reason I was basically, there's like two things about Bitcoin, two questions you could ask for like thinking about it as an investment where, one is like, is this a good investment? And two is, or, you know, is this a good bet? And two is like, will this actually succeed? And those things are kind of like independent because it could be a good bet without, you know, having certainty that it'll succeed or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so the good bet was sort of like an independent thing. I view it like very roughly as, you know, even if you still assigned it like a 50% fail case, which is much larger than most people would assign it. And you give it an upside that's sort of capped, but also floored at like the market cap of gold. It's like, you know, I don't know what it is right now, but maybe like 10x or something like that. It's like, okay, so you're presented with an opportunity to flip a coin. And if it's heads, you win 10x your wager. And if it's tails, you lose your wager. You know, most people are going to bet on that. It's just a matter of how much, which is a very personal question or whatever. But the question as to whether like it's actually going to succeed, the best way for me to like sort of evaluate that was actually just thinking of it as like a belief system and being like, look, like here's this thing that most people in the world, you know, this was as of like a few years ago, but it's still pretty much true. Most people in the world, you know, don't own this thing or at the time, like haven't even really heard of this thing. And what tends to happen when people hear about it or learn about it is they learn about it from someone who is into it and, you know, economically incentivized to have other people get into it. And so they believe in it. And when they get shared the belief, it's almost like sort of a religion of sorts. These people tend to, not everyone, but people tend to believe in it quite strongly. And the people who are, like, basically the number of people in the world who hadn't yet discovered it or believed in it or aligned themselves financially very strongly with it far outweighed the number of people who were already in it and were like sort of possible sellers, you know, disregarding the fact that even most of the people who are already in it have this sort of like hold mentality that they're not going to sell it. And so just like as a belief system, it's hard to imagine that continuing to play out in a way where more people don't demand Bitcoin than like the available supply. And like that fundamentally was kind of why I believed that Bitcoin would continue to be more valuable. Is that something that resonates with you at all? Or did you have like a different view of any kind?
Yeah, I mean, 100%. Like, I mean, if you think about what are the core belief systems that most people have in the world, or really everyone has in the world, either religion or country. And as I said earlier, I think like what cryptocurrencies have, Bitcoin being the first and kind of the authentic that catalyzed everything, right, is the ability to align economic incentives with people around the world who aren't connected by kind of land, but are connected by the internet, right? So kind of allowing, you know, billions of people in the world to kind of opt into these new, you know, kind of belief systems where they do have skin in the game, they do have incentives, right? That is the really interesting thing about cryptocurrency, I would say.
Yeah, so you mentioned the skin in the game. I would be remiss not to bring up the channel that you guys launched on Farcaster called Skin in the Game. You guys have like a Skin in the Game OG NFT. I'm like passively aware of it. I tried to mint the NFT earlier and I have to like move some ETH around. I will do that, but I haven't done it yet. But
you don't have warps?
Oh no, I have warps. Okay. I guess maybe I didn't. I might have tried it on OpenSea rather than on Farcaster, but I'll figure it out. I need to get my own skin in the game as we're talking about skin in the game. But what was like, you know, you could have named the channel after a million different things. Why skin in the game? And what's your guys' like sort of objective, if you have one, or what was the reasoning for doing that?
Well, I think having skin in the game is important and something that I want to encourage everyone to do. I think having skin in the game means owning a cryptocurrency and being aligned with, again, a cryptocurrency that you can be part of that, you know, with shared incentives and values. I think it means using Farcaster instead of Twitter, right? Like Twitter, 99% of users are just passively observing information. And to me, the really interesting thing about Farcaster, why it's going to be much larger and potentially even overtake Twitter one day, is it's giving people more skin in the game, right? Rather than just be a passive observer, you can actually be active in the feed. You can create your own channel. You can do mints in the feed. You can create NFTs and sell them in the feed. You can do transactions in the feed. So skin in the game is just like a vibe that I think is important. And I think I'm encouraging everyone to do. I think like, we talked about Balaji earlier. One of the things Balaji, one of his ideas that I strongly agree with is like the most important trend, you know, or one of them in the next, 10, 20 years is everyone becoming an owner, everyone becoming an investor. And that means having skin in the game. And there's lots of ways that that's playing out through cryptocurrencies, NFTs, prediction markets is another thing that I think is really important for the world that, that skin in the game encapsulates, right? It's like kind of the media can create narratives, but there's no actual skin in the game. And oftentimes those narratives that the media creates is not true, right? Prediction market where anyone who has information can contribute that information through actually putting skin in the game, you know, risking capital, that has the ability to bring a lot more truth to the world. So Yeah, that was a kind of a lot, but there's a lot of reasons why Skin the Game is kind of a vibe that I think is important, and I'm trying to champion a little bit.
Yeah, there's something interesting to, you know, you mentioned like poly market with the prediction markets. We've been talking about Farcaster. You guys invested in WorldCoin. There's something interesting with like these projects that are just they seem to be much more sort of like, I don't want to get the word wrong, but like user focused. Like they're just practically useful and kind of interesting for real people in the real world more so than they are, you know, super. Like you have to be really deep down the crypto rabbit hole to kind of become interested in these things, like, you know, a lot of DeFi projects or whatever. I'm not sure if there's others like sort of in the portfolio worth calling out. Another one that I like, it's not necessarily in that category, but you guys have an investment in Index Coop or Co-op. I don't know how you say it, but I've for a long time wanted to just like, you know, index the crypto market. Like I actually don't feel super strongly about like the ultimate outcome for Bitcoin or Ethereum or Solana or any of these cryptos, but I believe very strongly in crypto overall. And so if I could just place like market cap weighted bets in crypto overall, that'd be really interesting. And I know Index Coop is looking to do something like that, but is that theme that I talk about, like sort of being interesting for people kind of outside of crypto, roughly speaking, is that something that you explicitly look for, or it's just one sort of sign of many that you kind of tend to see in some of the projects that you invest in?
100%. I think what I, one of the skills that I have that's unique is understanding culture deeply and having a strong kind of vision for how crypto and culture kind of collide. And I think a lot of people in crypto are tend to be very kind of inward focused on kind of the crypto, whatever the crypto meta is, or whatever the, you know, the things that are working in crypto for crypto users. And I also think about that, like what we always say is like, it's gotta be crypto natives first with an eye towards a mass market. And so those are the things that we invest in, is like, we talk about the intersection of purist and tourist. That's another kind of mental model that we use, where like the purist is the person that's steeped in historical knowledge on the thing. The tourist is the person who doesn't give a shit about that, but just wants to create a product that resonates, or use a product that resonates. And so I think this is Virgil Abloh, his kind of mental model for how he designed products. And it really kind of resonates with me, and is how I think about crypto investing. It's like kind of the intersection of purist and tourist products that kind of start serving, you know, a problem that crypto natives have with an eye towards kind of just like, as you said, regular people. So pretty much, you know, we're investing in things that we think can do that. And, you know, sometimes it doesn't work, but a lot of things, especially lately, I think is getting more and more culture and crypto are colliding. And I think we're kind of uniquely positioned to there. It's, you know, NFT is a good example, right? It's like a lot of people in crypto missed NFTs completely because they didn't really get the culture aspect of it. Maybe they were only investing in like deep tech protocols or DeFi or whatever the narratives were. But, you know, very clearly NFTs as a category has kind of brought in, you know, crypto and culture in a very unique way. And more people in the world care about culture than they do about finance. So that's why, you know, NFTs have kind of grown the way they did. So we're definitely thinking a lot more about that these days. Like a recent investment as an example that it's not, they don't have a kind of mainnet product yet, but Move to Earn is a good example of like a category that I think is going to be culturally important. It's like, and there's been attempts that maybe were too purist so far or too tourist, but no one's found the right balance. And I think, you know, a product that incentivizes people to be active in a way that can't be gameable is the potentially a good on-ramp for more people into cryptocurrency, right? So things like that.
Yeah, no, I love that category. I that's similar to like the social media where the crypto social media stuff where like Sweatcoin and Stepin were like, I was like, these are interesting projects, like I want to play with these. Whereas like most of the DeFi stuff, I just kind of like don't really, they're just fundamentally not interesting. Like I'm sure there's money to be made in them or whatever, but the stuff that is fundamentally interesting, maybe it's kind of like the same for you. I don't know. I don't know if most people in the world are kind of like me. In fact, I think like in a lot of ways they're probably not, but nonetheless, the things that sort of like surpass that fundamental interest threshold for me, I think tend to be things that are more widely interesting to a larger population than just those deep down the rabbit hole. So anyway, I know we're up on time and I want to be respectful of yours, but really appreciate you taking the time and awesome conversation. Look forward to keeping in touch, following along with One Confirmation and getting my skin in the game.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Jake. Yeah, this is a fun pod. I really appreciate it. And yeah, let's talk again.